This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
We'll hear argument next in case 20-1199, Students for Fair Admissions versus the President and Fellows of Harvard College.
Sometime soon, in the next few months, the Supreme Court is expected to hand down a landmark ruling on the future of affirmative action. Oral arguments took place last October, and in one case, an advocacy group has sued Harvard University, saying that any consideration of race violates part of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Here's the lead attorney for Harvard being questioned by Chief Justice Roberts.
There is no doubt that as the testimony showed, that for applicants who are essentially so strong on multiple dimensions, that they are sort of on the bubble, that they're a real candidate for admission, being African American, or being Hispanic, or in some instances being Asian American, can provide one of many, many tips that will put you in.
People say that, yes, but you will have to concede that if it provides one of many, then in some cases it will be determinative.
I do concede that.
Okay, so we're talking about race as a determining factor in admission to Harvard.
20 years ago, the Supreme Court upheld affirmative action. The decision was written by Sandra Day O'Connor, a Republican appointee. Now in 2023, the conservative majority in the court is likely to reverse precedent, as it did in Roe versus Wade, and end the practice of affirmative action.
Race for some highly qualified applicants can be the determinative factor, just as being an oboe player in a year in which the Harvard Radcliffe Orchestra needs an oboe player will be the tip.
We did not fight a civil war about oboe players.
We
did fight a civil war to eliminate racial discrimination, and that's why it's a matter of considerable concern.
There are actually two cases being decided, and they may have a profound impact on generations of students. So I'm going to talk today with two long-serving university presidents who have had front row seats to this battle. But first, I want to talk with someone who's already been dealing with this situation in an admissions office. Femi Ogundeli is Dean of Undergraduate Admissions at the University of California at Berkeley. In California, public colleges ended any consideration of race a full generation ago.
So when we are reviewing applications at the University of California at all of the schools, we are unable to see an applicant's race or gender in the actual applicant file.
In fact, California, ostensibly liberal California, was the first state to ban affirmative action. That happened in 1996 with a ballot initiative known as Proposition 209. And shortly after that, the percentage of Black and Latino students admitted to Berkeley fell sharply. Now, how did you react when you first got the news that this would be the case in your life going forward?
Yeah, I'll be honest with you. So my entire background has been doing multicultural recruitment work at a variety of institutions. And prior to my time at Cal, I was at Stanford University here in California in the Bay Area, And I had not heard of Prop 209 when I was at Stanford. And that's because Stanford and the private institutions in California are not required to adhere to Prop 209. And so it wasn't until I started interviewing and doing my research on Cal prior to taking the job that I understood what Prop 209 was, and more importantly, how it was impacting the university system. And so I took a look at some of the research and some of the reports that really showed that despite millions of dollars of investment that has come from the state and, you know, really strong efforts across the institutions, that ever since Prop 209 happened, we saw a significant decline in Black and Latinx students being admitted to the UCs. And there hasn't really been a strong rebound in that. Although there's been tons of effort and there's been some gains, they have not rebounded to the pre-Prop 209 numbers.
It is very likely, considering this, the composition of the present Supreme Court, that affirmative action is going to be eliminated at colleges and universities across the nation. So are you starting to hear from administrators at other schools outside of California looking to glean some modus operandi from your experience?
Yes, absolutely. And I don't think it's just the University of California, right? There's about 8 states or so across the country right now that have affirmative action bans. And I think a lot of us are being kind of tapped on the shoulder and asked, like, how are you doing what you're doing in this new kind of reality? And I just want to be very clear. I do not think that there is any race-neutral alternative to creating diversity on a college campus without being able to consider race. Mm-hmm. However, I do think that we can do better than what we've done. And so what I mean by that is really just recognizing that the K-12 experience, and I have traveled all across the state, all across the country, all across the world recruiting students, the K-12 experience is not standard. There are varying opportunities out there, and there are varying ways in which students are able to even participate in those opportunities, oftentimes delineated by socioeconomic status. And so what that means for us is that when we start to consider applicants here at our institution, we have to take that context into consideration. And then when you seek broad geographic diversity, I think what you'll find is that it does allow for a much more diverse and yet equally talented group of students to emerge in your pool than before.
Now, if I were to walk onto the Berkeley campus today, and if I had walked on the Berkeley campus a few years ago, would it be noticeably different?
I know that the last couple of years we have been able to have some of the more diverse classes that we've had since Prop 209. Where I will tell you in particular, I think that Prop 209, and one of the things that I'm still working through, is I think that it particularly hurts Black students and Black applicants. I'm not exactly sure as to why. But I can tell you that with all of the efforts that we've created to diversify this campus, I've seen really strong gains in pretty much every other ethnic category except for the Black number. And that is something that I'm still kind of working my way through to try to understand how and why that is the case.
What other factors can you take into consideration? Are you still using the ACT and the SAT?
So no. So the UC, right before the pandemic, we went test free. And so we are not considering the SAT or the ACT. We do still take a look at AP coursework, and that is a sign of rigor. Same thing with IB, the International Baccalaureate coursework. But I also recognize that even the AP exams, there's a financial barrier. Not everybody who takes an AP class is even able to take the AP exam. The other piece that we did add to our evaluation is that came from College Board was the landscape data. And landscape is a tool that really allows you to assess context of applicants. It tells you everything around both the neighborhood that students might be coming from, percentage of free or reduced price lunch, percentage of first generation students that might be in a high school, and other really important pieces of information.
So crudely put, and forgive me for this, but crudely put, in other words, you're able to guess to some extent what you before had more solidly as information about people's backgrounds.
In a perfect world, I think that you should be able to consider both race and use something like landscape data.
Right.
because race is no longer a proxy the way that it used to be. I think that it's important for folks to know that Black does not mean first gen, rural does not mean poor, right?
Let's not mince words. It sounds to me like your job in doing that, as you believe it is proper to do, got a hell of a lot harder with the elimination of affirmative action.
A hell of a lot harder, because as you can see, the institutions still value diversity as a part of academic excellence, right? And so when you take, you know, two, I think, particularly strong identifiers around diversity away, it really does put a lot of weight into us understanding these contexts to try to put together a class that is more representative of this broader term diversity.
So one critique of affirmative action is that it disproportionately helps students of color from privileged backgrounds, middle, upper middle, upper class, rather than those from poor or underprivileged communities. In your experience at other schools, and it's a wide experience, have you found that to be the case?
No, actually, I have not. And again, affirmative action to me gives you license to consider things. It does not mean that you advantage a group, right? That to me is where the conversation on affirmative action oftentimes gets reduced to. And I can tell you that the best institutions that can consider affirmative action, some of the most selective institutions, like my time at Stanford, when we talked around students, we didn't just talk about their race. We talked about their socioeconomic status. We talked about what their high school offered. We talked about, did a student go above and beyond what their high school offered? And what does that look like in certain contexts? We also talked about, what does it mean to be the one and the only in an environment? And whether that is a woman in STEM, whether that is an out queer student in the Bible Belt, whether that is, a student in an urban environment, like all of those different experiences, again, when we talk about crafting and creating community, were important to us, right? And those things are still important. They're still important to me. And so affirmative action, I think, is the beginning of the conversation. And what I'm struck by is how it's become a larger conversation rather than getting people to understand what it gives license to do versus what it, like, quote unquote, makes people do or requires people to do.
Femi Okundeli is Dean of Undergraduate Admission at UC Berkeley. He began there in 2019.
What role do you think race or ethnicity should play in the college admission process?
Well, I mean, obviously it's a complicated question.
None. In my opinion, your race or your ethnicity or whatever, you know, whatever other factors like that, your sex, shouldn't play any role. If he passes the tests, I don't care who you are. I don't care what you represent. Like, you're entitled to study here.
I'm a Chinese American, and I think it's kind of known knowledge that race-aware admissions and affirmative action is sort of disadvantaged, not just me, but a lot of other Asians as well.
I think that affirmative action is like a band-aid in the sense that if you wanted a more systemic change to society, I think that there are more effective ways.
I believe that my race played a huge role in my success in high school, and I think that it's only fair if my race plays a role into the way that my application is viewed.
My community was majority Hispanic, so I saw a lot of kids who were just born into families that just had less privilege, had less knowledge of the system, but who benefited from the system and now are doing, like, beautiful things.
As a person who is actively negatively affected by affirmative action, I know I should support affirmative action, but I don't.
Student voices from the Columbia and Cornell University campuses in New York. We'll continue looking at affirmative action and what happens if it ends in college admissions in a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from the New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We're looking today at affirmative action and what may come after affirmative action if a major Supreme Court decision ends the practice. To help think through what's at stake here, I'm joined by two very prominent university leaders. Ruth Simmons testified in the Supreme Court case Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard, and she's the former president of Brown University and recently stepped down from Prairie View A&M in Texas. Lee Bollinger, when he was president of the University of Michigan, was the defendant in an earlier Supreme Court case that upheld affirmative action in 2003. And he's been the president of Columbia University for many years.
You both have led universities and have been attached to this subject for many years. It means an enormous amount to you both, both personally and professionally. What is at stake now that we are facing the very, very possible elimination of affirmative action in the Supreme Court?
Well, as I said in my testimony in the Harvard case, for me, it's quite simply the question of what will become of us as a nation if we go into our separate enclaves without the opportunity to interact and to learn from each other. What will we become? What will become of us, frankly? We're seeing a lot of behavior play out today, as it has in the past, with regard to individuals pursuing violence against individuals that they regard perhaps as threats, perhaps as just being too different, perhaps as being not part of the country that they want to be a part of. But the point is that affirmative action and diversity helps us achieve the goal of maintaining a common framework for a very diverse nation, allowing us to confer, elect representatives, to make major decisions in the direction of the country, and honestly, I should say also to live happy lives.
It's very important to understand, I think, how the policies came into effect and how they have been opposed over many decades. I mean, what we're seeing today is in a very important sense what we've seen every decade since affirmative action began. And selective universities, colleges all across the United States looked at the movements of civil rights and the Brown versus Board of Education effort to desegregate schools and the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act and all the efforts of that period, which in many ways was a high point in American history. And universities said, we cannot continue to have student bodies that are all white and all male. And we must take steps to rectify this and do our part, which is a limited part. of the whole national effort to try to overcome the legacy of invidious discrimination, especially against African Americans. That's the beginning. I would say that, you know, there are a lot of very bad motives behind the opposition to affirmative action, as Ruth has articulated. There's also a completely legitimate and reasonable argument.
Well, let's do both of those. What are the various motivations behind the argument for case behind opposing affirmative action and bringing it down?
Yeah. So I think, you know, there is obviously in some parts of the society outright racist motivation to try to reject the whole history since Brown versus Board of Education. There's also misunderstandings, this sense that I lose if I'm in a world in which other people's race, ethnicity can be taken into account. And the problem there is that we take into account lots of things. We take into account geographic diversity. We want students from different parts of the United States. That's always been true in order to try to build a national polity.
Legacies, the size of people's bank accounts, legacies, how good they are at football.
Yeah, there are many, many things that are taken into account. So singling out this one is problematic. However, when you have a serious, reasonable discussion about affirmative action, you hear arguments like the following. This is the most powerful in my view. We have spent a half century, a century, a civil war before that, trying to get the society to realize that taking into account race for bad motivation, for bad purposes, is something we must struggle to stop and overcome. And you are asking us for an exception to that. You're saying consideration of race for good purposes should be allowed. So if we really want a colorblind society, we should just say you can never in public policy take race into account, and not even for good purposes.
And Ruth Simmons, how would you counter that argument?
Well, I would counter it with the fact that we have a lived history that proves that without some extraordinary measure like affirmative action, we will continue on a path to being an unequal society where people are treated not on the basis of their worth or their merit, but on the basis of what the color of their skin is, or what their gender is, or what their preference is, and so forth. That's the kind of society we have shown ourselves to be in the past. And there is no overwhelming evidence that I see that we're on a path to be different from what we've done in the past.
In fact, in many ways, some place like, you know, liberal New York City has as segregated a school system de facto
as
any in the nation. You do hear, and just I present this argument, I don't endorse it, that, well, wait a minute, this has been going on for decades, so-called racial preferences in higher education admissions. When does it end? Should it end? Is this open-ended, Ruth Simmons?
Well, I'm sure I would say we don't know. There are a lot of things that we do with uncertainty about what the end game will actually be. But I would make the argument that by continuing to do this work and to show that we endorse policies of trying to eliminate inequities, that we are speaking to generations being born who otherwise would feel inclined to give up on the country that they're from. Now, since I lived that reality, I was born at a time when the public policy actually was quite the opposite. I was born in rural East Texas. My parents were sharecroppers initially and later moved to the city. As a child, I understood that I had no future, that I had no opportunity to be respected for what I was and for what I could achieve. I understood that. It was spoken directly to me on a daily basis. And yet, by availing myself of education, I was able to escape hating my own country. And that's what I want children being born to be able to do, to see that somebody is capable of shaping policies to prevent these pernicious practices from occurring. And so I worry less about the people who are angry that their child didn't get into Columbia. I worry less about the person who's angry because they thought they should be making $50,000 a year more. I'm worried about the children who are coming into the world and what they see in terms of these policies. That's what I worry about.
Prairie View A&M is a historically Black university. What impact will dismantling affirmative action have on HBCUs, Ruth Simmons? Where will this take the future?
Well, many people believe that it will cause many African Americans, of course, to enroll in HBCUs. But I would say that isn't the only thing that might impel them to do so. The climate itself is frightening to young people. Mm. And after every incident in which African Americans and minorities are targeted, especially in violent ways, we see consequences in the enrollment of our institutions. It is a frightening time for many young people who did not go through the turbulent civil rights era, and therefore some find themselves at a loss to understand why people hate them and why people would deny them basic rights. So many people believe, and frankly, some anticipate with glee, that this will cause students to go into HBCUs and other minority-serving institutions in higher proportion. I'm less enthusiastic about that outcome, I have to tell you, because you cannot believe that this country needs to learn how to interact across many forms of difference to survive and thrive and think it's a good idea for every Black person to be in a Black institution. It just isn't. So I think we should be very cautious in celebrating the fact that African Americans might flee to our institutions. I think we ought to uphold the standards that we held so dear during the period of integration and insist that we have to be as true to those standards as anybody else that we castigate for not being true to them.
You sometimes hear the argument that what's most important is economics, not race. And the best thing to do for any kind of affirmative action would be to affirmatively focus on admissions for people who did not have economic opportunity above all. How do you answer that? Maybe Lee Bollinger?
So the argument is, as you put it, you can still have racial and ethnic diversity, but consider socioeconomic status, and then you won't be having to focus on race, ethnicity, and you'll be able to have both things. You'll do good for people who are facing an unequal world in socioeconomic ways, and you will have racial and ethnic diversity. And there has been a lot of scholarship on this, and a lot of, again, actual examples. And the truth is, if you cannot consider race and all you know is the socioeconomic standing of the applicant, you are much more likely to admit another white student. Hmm. That's just the reality.
Ruth Simmons?
I mean, how could one quarrel with considering economic circumstances? to give a leg up to candidates. Who would say that isn't something that would be admirable to do? There's just one problem with that, and that is we still are not answering the question of what we do about a society that for all of its advantages is still deeply divided. What are we thinking in this country if we believe that we really should ignore every particularity of an individual when we're making these decisions? Instead, we should be bringing people together to help them understand how to form a nation that truly can live up to its ideals. How will we do that if we don't consider all of these attributes?
Lee Bollinger, Ruth Simmons, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, David.
The Supreme Court's decision in Students for Fair Admission versus Harvard is expected sometime this spring. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. 10 years ago, the Catholic Church faced a startling situation, unprecedented in modern times. The Pope, Pope Benedict, resigned. And when his successor was appointed, Pope Francis, he too was a break from the past. He was the first pope from Latin America, in fact, the first non-European pope for a millennium. And Francis seemed far more willing to engage with contemporary problems. He wrote an encyclical, A Letter to the Faithful, on the climate emergency, talking about consumerism and irresponsible development. Francis also struck a very different tone on gay rights. But as much as Francis has been more open than previous popes on a series of issues, the reaction against him from traditionalists has been all the more outspoken and truly angry at times. How exactly did the culture wars come to the Vatican and the Catholic Church? Paul Eli just published a piece about a decade of Francis's leadership. Paul, after a decade, what stands out for you as the most notable efforts and achievements of this pope?
Well, Pope Francis has done so much on the environment, on the opening of the church to non-Christian religions, on focusing the church outward toward the poor, on cleaning up the structure of the Vatican, and making a lot of fresh appointments both in Rome and around the world. But what really stands out to me is the openness that he's brought to the church, a church that felt closed and locked down after years of fairly authoritarian leadership under John Paul II and then Benedict XVI, is now open and showing signs of change.
Paul, now I'm looking at this from obviously way outside the church, but it seems from what I understand, from what I read, that opposition to the Pope is much blunter than ever before, anything we've ever seen. Sometimes it's even contemptuous of what he's trying to do. Please talk about that.
So, leaders in the church who've had grievances with him have expressed them in any number of ways. One has written a series of incendiary letters criticizing Pope Francis in all sorts of ways and spread them through the internet, gaining the approval of a lot of traditionalist bishops and some cardinals too. Another evidently wrote a letter and had it distributed anonymously under a pseudonym saying that Pope Francis' pontificate has been a disaster, insinuating that everybody thinks this, and then ticking off all the things that have made it disastrous. So there's secret letters, there's open letters, broadcasters, especially on the EWTN television network, suggesting that Francis is a heretic or something like that. Now, in their opposition to Pope Francis, the traditionalists have a lot on their side. They really believe that he's wrong to relax and open things up in the way that he's done. They've got a lot of doctrine, a lot of history, and the pretty strong precedent of the two previous popes on their side. And on top of that, and this is the real twist, they're opposing Francis in a church that, because he's made it more open, they're free to do so. He's not shutting them down in the way that one of his predecessors might. So they're taking advantage of the open church that he's brought about and using that openness to openly criticize him.
Paul, you spoke with a number of people in different relations to the church while writing about Francis, including a bishop in the state of Connecticut. Tell me about him.
When people in the church talk about the next generation of leaders in the church in big archdioceses like New York, the name Frank Caggiano often comes up. I first met Bishop Caggiano, who's now the Bishop of Bridgeport, when I was reporting an article on clerical sex abuse for the magazine a few years back. He's a native of Brooklyn, where I live, and spent years in various positions in the church in New York, really getting to know the nuts and bolts of how a big city church works. For all that, and through his participation in various World Youth Days, he's got his eye on the next generation of people in the church's future. Bishop Frank, you said, and this was on your podcast, that Pope Francis has been a counterbalance to Pope John Paul II and to Pope Benedict XVI. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. Pope John Paul, who is now among the saints, he very much made a priority the clarity of the teaching of what the church holds. And it was sorely needed when he became pope. And Pope Benedict, his genius, God rest his soul, was that he was a master catechist. That in many ways he took the very complex notions that John Paul would teach in his encyclicals, which many times caused me to pause and read and reread and reread because of his deep philosophical training, and make them accessible to the average person. Now, Pope Francis complements that. How? He's complementing the truth with what I'm going to say, the call also to do what Ephesians 4 says, which is to live the truth in love or in mercy or in encounter, whatever word you wish. It is what John Paul and Benedict and Francis together, when you hold them together, you're painting a fuller picture of the human condition, its brokenness, the need for people to be accompanied in their suffering, in mercy, in acceptance, in welcome, but at the same time leading them to a destination. And unfortunately, we live in a time where people are not comfortable seeing the full picture, but would like to emphasize only half the picture. And that's when we kind of get into trouble.
But on to particular conflicts. I mean, Pope Francis has done things that you could understand why other bishops would respond to him. Mm-hmm. His position on gay people, he's leaving the teaching alone, but suggested in various ways that there's got to be a much more open pastoral outreach towards gay people. Is that effective in your view?
Well, I think it's a longstanding position of the church. I think what's new, if there's something new, is that he is highlighting it as a pastoral priority. But I think, for example, the fact that even the Catechism of the Church speaks of the need to welcome those who have same-sex attraction, gay, lesbian, Catholics, and others. And it also speaks of the sin of discrimination against those who may be gay or lesbian or any sort of discrimination of any type. It's clear. I think where the difficulty has been is how do you do that in a way where we're not just giving lip service to say you are welcome, but also we engage in the issues that really burn in their hearts. And how do we respond to those without necessarily abandoning what the church has held as its teachings for centuries? That is where you have this legitimate disagreement among voices in the church.
Pope Francis has spoken to the need for the church to involve women in leadership roles more. Mm-hmm. You've done that. You've gone boldly. You've named a woman, Eleanor Sowers, as the parish life coordinator at St. Anthony of Padua in Fairfield. Now that's, essentially, she's the person in charge of the parish. What should Pope Francis be doing along these lines to bring women into greater leadership roles in the church?
Well, you know what, Paul? I think if you look at the record of what he has done, even at the Vatican, he is beginning to put women in significant positions of leadership. For example, Sister Natalie's in the Synod office.
Sister Natalie Bécart, right?
Yes. She is a voting member of the Synod. That's the first, in to my knowledge, in history, that she is a full voting member.
This is the Synod of Bishops, which has to do with the appointment of bishops and with other clergy, is that right?
Correct, right? And with the Synod on Synodality, when she sits at the Synod, she will be voting as an equal to the bishops, which is a first.
To what extent can we see it growing? Can we see Sister Natalie leading the Congregation for Bishops or a woman of like her becoming a bishop at some point?
My hunch is that that would not happen anytime soon.
So just to be clear, this is... all that you're setting out is based on the understanding that the ordained ministry is going to be restricted to men, and so men are priests, and then men can be bishops. So if you're going to look for roles for women, it's going to be non-ordained roles.
Yeah, I do not envision that, for whatever reason. I mean, we could talk about it too if you wish, but I do not imagine that women would be called to ordained priesthood in the Catholic Church. And one could argue the pros and cons of that. I think there are theological reasons for that. I do not imagine that happening. Certainly not my lifetime. I'm 64 years old. It is not going to happen in the next, whatever, 20 years or 25 years that I have left. That is not going to happen.
Bishop Caggiano, he's ardent for Pope Francis, still sees Pope Francis as strongly in continuity with his two predecessors. Professor Kathleen Cavaney of Boston College Law School is right at the center of so many of the conflicts in the Church of the United States today. She teaches law at Boston College. She's also trained in theology, two disciplines that make her a match for the male bishops who lead the church. At Boston College and before that at Notre Dame Law School, she was colleagues and rubbed shoulders with many of the most aggressive traditionalists in the Catholic Church today. And that's one reason that I always get so much out of our conversations. Kathy, welcome.
It's a delight to be here.
In a comment that I've written for The New Yorker, I note that Pope Francis's election was unexpected. And then I go on to propose or argue that a pretty steady run of unexpected developments through his pontificate has brought about a church that's more open and more dynamic than the church that preceded it under John Paul and Benedict. What do you think?
I think that the mark of, remember, from John Paul through Benedict, you had almost an extended papacy under much the same vision, because Benedict was such an enormous part of John Paul II's, you know, intellectual program. Not that they didn't have differences.
He was working for him. He was
working
prefect
for him.
Of
he
the
was,
Congregation for Doctrine, and right. They were elbow to elbow, I guess.
Right. And then when people got Benedict, they thought, well, we're just going to continue in this line for the immediate future. I mean, it could have continued from 2005 to late 2022, right? He died on December 31st. Benedict did, that is. So when Francis comes in and isn't out of that mode, is someone who really didn't expect to be Pope. My image of Francis is the image they had of him sort of sitting on the subway, you know, in Argentina and, you know, just going about his business as a cardinal who was focusing on, you know, caring for the poor in his own region. And then,
so that's a great image. And he's wearing black. I think he's wearing a dark overcoat. He's got bags under his eyes. The subway looks much like the subway in New York. And he was known at the time for living simply and traveling to the outskirts by public transport. And so this is an image of Pope Francis, you know, prior to his election and all that has happened subsequent. And that really stands out in your mind.
It stands out in my mind because I think, you know, I mean, I guess I'm kind of a cynical person in some way. You know, so like when you look at like the Supreme Court justices and that, you know, they all have to live a certain way, get a certain path in order to make it, you know, to the position that they want.
The career ladder.
You know, same thing. Yeah, the career ladder. Same thing with cardinals, right? You know, if you have to do the career ladder. Same thing if you're a cardinal and you want to be a pope. And this is someone who was not living this life because he had ambitions of being pope. You know, he thought his chance was over. So he was living how he thought he should live before God. And that was simply and in an encounter with the poor.
You've written that since Francis was elected 10 years ago, we've seen a divide among the U.S. bishops, not between liberals and conservatives so much as between what you call culture warrior bishops and culture of encounter bishops. What does that mean?
Well, I think it means a couple of things. I think for both Pope John Paul II, Pope St. John Paul II, and Pope Benedict, the main problem that the church faced in the West was a kind of moral relativism, a sense that the moral norms that protected the dignity of the human being and the community were being eroded by capitalistic liberalism. And they saw a very stark choice. And Pope John Paul II issued an encyclical, I think it was in 1995, called Evangelium Vitae, the culture, you know, the gospel of life, which set the gospel of life on the one hand against, you know, death, a culture of life against a culture of death. And
which he identified that, with liberal, progressive, capitalist, anything-goes society in places like the United States.
Anything-goes society. Exactly. And the marks of the culture of death were, you know, each individual gets to decide what's best for them, acceptance of autonomy and choices of abortion, contraception, assisted suicide, euthanasia, but also lack of care for the poor, too. That part of it was missing when it was encountered. And versus a culture of life, which prohibited behavior like abortion and euthanasia, but also provided support for the vulnerable, you know, great support for families. So, you know, what happened in the United States was that the culture wars that were marking the United States were kind of fused with John Paul II's culture of life versus culture of death and parceled out to each party. So many bishops, many conservative Catholics saw the Republican Party as advancing the culture of life and the Democratic Party as the culture of death. Now, if you just look at John Paul II's encyclical, that's not, you know, that's not an accurate parsing of the parties, because it's true that the Republican Party opposed abortion and euthanasia, but the Democratic Party called for all the social support for the vulnerable. But that's how it got configured in the U.S., culture of life, Republican Party, culture of death, Democratic Party. And then once you have that as your frame, then some bishops start to enforce that frame, sometimes by threatening to deny communion, as we've seen happen.
So those are the culture warrior bishops taking
a
diminished reading of John Paul II's vision and applying it to American politics. So then the culture of encounter is an expression and a way of seeing things associated with Pope Francis. Can you explain that and then how it works itself out in the mission of certain of the bishops that Francis has appointed?
Well, I think that the conservatives are worried, I think, that, you know, the big problem that John Paul and Benedict saw, moral relativism, that was kind of pushed back against by their culture wars, is not appreciated by Pope Francis. That's what their fear is.
He doesn't care about the truth.
Right. That's what they worry about. In my view, however, Francis recognizes that the problem is much deeper than moral relativism, that the problem is actually moral nihilism. Moral nihilism says, on an existential level, nothing matters. The question of truth doesn't even come up because nothing matters. And I think Pope Francis's culture of encounter— I am going to encounter you. I am going to say that you matter in your wholeness is a response to the deeper problem of moral nihilism.
So given all this, that we have culture of encounter as really one of the most important ideas to come out of Pope Francis' pontificate and his attempt to push beyond the culture wars, it's rich, isn't it, that his pontificate has coincided with moment of great intensity in the culture wars driven by Catholic public figures, traditionalist Catholics for the most part. Isn't that right?
Yeah, I think some of this is a parochialism of America. North America, not the whole America, but the American, North American bishops, I think, see the world, not all of them, but, through the frame of American politics. And because the culture of life versus culture of death had gotten fed into American politics, they can't see how what Pope Francis is doing in the culture of encounter is actually a continuation in a new context, in some ways, of what Pope John Paul II was doing. They view him as an opposition to that. And that's the problem, right? Because what happened is Pope Francis looks like he, unlocked Pandora's box and is allowing conversation about things that they don't think that people should talk about. He's also, I think, decentering academic theology in a helpful way. I mean, what he is ultimately saying is something that the church teaches, which is faith is an encounter with a human person. Faith is an encounter with Jesus Christ, mediated by the church. But there's a reality here. Faith isn't simply repeating a proposition that's included in the catechism that on its own isn't life-giving. So Pope Francis recognizes that the church isn't dead. The church is the living faith of the dead, not the dead faith of the living.
That's Kathleen Cavaney, a professor in theology and law at Boston College. And we heard earlier from Bishop Frank Caggiano. Paul Eli has written for The New Yorker since 2014, and he's a senior fellow at Georgetown University. You can read him on Pope Francis and much more at newyorker.com. That's our program for today. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbes of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado and Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Max Balton, Brita Green, Adam Howard, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Jeffrey Masters, Louis Mitchell, and Ngofen Mputabuele, with guidance from Emily Botine and assistance from Harrison Keithline and Meher Bhatia. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.